This is a podcast from the Rhodes Trust, which was recorded live at the 110th Rhodes Anniversary in Oxford. In this edition, Roxanne Joyal, Charles Conn, Professor Barry Nailbuff, John McCormack Bain, and Yusuf Randera Rees discuss the future of entrepreneurship.
Greetings and welcome to our panel. We have, as you can see, an incredibly star-studded, jam-packed adventure for you. I have asked each of the participants to keep their remarks to 8.5 minutes, and that, in theory, will allow us to have a short amount of time for questioning, which I think we'll do at the end. So I'm not going to spend any real time on introductions, just give you a sense of the order. It'll be Roxanne, then Charles, then myself, then John, and then Yusuf, and I think you'll get to learn a little bit about each of us through that. And it, 9 minutes, if they're still talking, we'll probably hear a beep go off. So with that, Roxanne, the floor is yours. Let's see, we have to do something here. How do we do this? Does anybody know?
I was told we launched a deck here.
Okay.
No, because there is a different order.
Oh, I see. So they're all...
They're all pre-ordered, but we could just...
I see, but you found yours.
That's it.
Okay.
Yep, good. All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Roxanne Joyal, and I'm the co-CEO of MeToWe. And let me preface that the opportunity to speak to you today about social entrepreneurship is something I do very humbly. I very much realize I'm in a room full of experts in intellect, so please take what I say with a grain of salt, and this has been my journey here over the last 10 years. And so when I came back from Oxford 10 years ago, and probably one of the reasons that I had the opportunity to study law here at Hartford in Oxford is because I am one of the founding employees of an organization called Free the Children. And that is an organization that is based in Canada. It was founded in 1995 by a then 12-year-old named Craig Kielberger. And this organization has become part of the fabric of youth in Canadian society. Incidentally, the executive director of that organization is Mark Kielberger, who is also a Rhodes Scholar from 2000 in Ontario. And so Free the Children has a dual mandate, and I will get to the business bit here very shortly, but I do want to take you a little bit through the background. It has a dual mandate. Our first mandate is to educate, engage, and empower young people to become lifelong active citizens. And one of the ways in which we do this is through our We Days. And this is a year-long educational initiative that is a year-long series of programs in which young people get involved and culminates in an inspirational event which gathers 20,000 young people in one place, and we do this in 9 cities across Canada to celebrate social change. And we really are at Free the Children about, we're all about the deliverables, the social impacts. And so in 2011, we had the opportunity to hire Mission Measurement out of the Kellogg School of Business. And they were able to survey our alumni from these programs. And what was really exciting to see is that it revealed that 80% of Free the Children alumni volunteered more than 150 hours last year. And 79% of them voted in their last national election, which is double that of their peers. The other mandate of what we do at Free the Children is, our international development wing, which is called Adopt a Village, and we're active in 7 countries. Primarily, we've been able to build along, because of the efforts of young people, we've been able to build about 650 schools. We educate 55,000 young people every single day, and we have about 1.7 million young people involved in our educational initiatives around the world. And we really are about sustainability. And to that end, despite the positive strides that we've been able to make over time, the question of financial sustainability is always at the fore. And really, this came to a head in 2008 with the financial crisis, as many other things did. Also, the confluence of factors such as fleeting worldwide attention on severe global issues, as well as changing mandates with institutional and government funding, really led us to think about what we could do to fund Free the Children in a sustainable way. In fact, if you look at Stats Canada, Canadians give about 0.7% of their annual salary to charity. And so there are many NGOs who are fighting over a very small piece of real estate. And so what Mark and I and Craig decided to do was to try to grow that pie through social enterprise. And it turns out that Canadians spend 71% of their annual salaries on financial responsibilities and consumables. So we decided to jump into that enterprise sphere in order to be able to generate an independent source of income for Free the Children. And so with that in mind, we founded Me2E, which is a social enterprise. It is a business, I'll be forthright about that, but it has very specific things within its mandate. It is about providing goods and experiences that are responsibly manufactured and sold. It's about a positive financial impact for Free the Children, and it also is about transparency in the impact that it provides to the consumer themselves. And so we have international volunteer trips, we have ethically manufactured apparel and accessories, we really have motivational books, we have camps for young people who inspire. It really is about empowering a young generation of people to participate and to vote for change with their wallets. And so, again, this is all, Mark and I are both lawyers, we both studied law here at Hartford, as I mentioned, and so the first thing we did is we marched straight to our lawyers to make sure that this is all going to be done in good order. So we've dotted all our I's and crossed all of our T's. So we're, you know, all of our donations to Free the Children are independently evaluated. We're able to do what Free the Children cannot. And I know the land of social enterprise here in the UK is actually much more advanced. I mean, we're very lucky to see the streets on the shops on the high street with Oxfam. But that landscape is very different in Canada, and it's very difficult for charities to be able to generate their own income through the sale of goods. And so by founding the social enterprise, we're able to really deliver a sustainable funding base for Free the Children. And the whole goal actually is to fund what donors do not want to fund, which is typically admin. And our eventual goal is to bring Free the Children's administrative rate down to zero, currently 10, which is half the industry average. And just quickly, in terms of our success, we founded Me2E in 2008, and we're very proud to say that in the last 5 years, we've been able to give $5 million to Free the Children in cash and in-kind donations. And again, really freeing Free the Children to be able to reduce its administrative rate. We're able to fund projects that donors do not want to fund. And we also are able to give a pot of money to Free the Children in order to innovate without risk. And so it really is something that's in its infancy. We're very proud to say that we've been able to directly impact about 500,000 people to date. And we really push our staff, and we're about 300 staff now between Free the Children and Me2E in Toronto. And then we have another staff, about 200 globally. But we really push our staff to really think about the why and what they do. And one such story is about Mama Toti, and I'll end on that point. And she is one of the artisans with whom we work in our accessories division at Me2E. We employ about 650 women in Kenya who create these fair trade accessories that are sold around the world. We're really excited to say that we're launching in Nordstrom's in the US in about 3 weeks' time, so that's very exciting. But again, the story of Mama Toti is one of a woman who never felt as though she counted in her society, and the ability to earn a paycheck and to be honored for her heritage really made her feel as though she could count as a person. And she told us that one thing she's always wanted to do is own a goat. And so with her first paycheck, she went straight to the local market. Not only did she buy herself one goat, but she was able to buy herself two. And all being people of business here, we know very well that two goats beget many more goats. And so that's been a very successful enterprise for her. So it's been a very fulfilling journey for me. I'm very grateful to the Rhodes for having provided me with the freedom coming out of law school to not be crushed by student debt and to really to be able to pursue my passion. And this is our way of giving back. So thank you so much for your time today.
Charles, do you want to just put it so it's in the presenter mode? I don't know if that'll help or not.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Oh, no, I'm not going to use this device.
Fine. Then actually, you can probably then see if I can blank the screen. Let's see if this does that. No?
No, not working.
I didn't talk about goats.
Okay, well, I just leave it as goats.
We can leave it on goats.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's distracting.
My story is going to be a little bit different, which is sort of about a lesson that I learned building a number of different companies and also nonprofit institutions, and it came as a surprise to me, and it's an accumulation of experience. I became an entrepreneur at age 34, after having been an economist and McKinsey partner. In fact, Barry was one of my big heroes, who was 3 years before me, and you know made his way through. Incredible academic success as an economist. As an academically oriented McKinsey partner, I thought that beautifully designed strategies were 90% of what it took to make a company successful. Yeah, you know the punchline. I could probably finish right now. I pretty quickly learned it was more like 10% necessary condition, but not sufficient condition. And then all of my lessons were about how to develop and build the right team to be successful, which is not at all what I expected. We started, my friends and I started an online city guide called City Search, and we did it with perfect timing, just as Microsoft and AOL were both starting their online city guides. Walt Mossberg, who many of you know, wrote about us in the Wall Street Journal. This was in March of 1996, and he basically said, "This looks really great, but they're about to get clobbered." And actually, that's not what happened. They had armies of people and bushels of money, and we didn't really have anything. And in the end, we were successful, at least for a while. And I think that the difference for us was we ended up having the best people. And it wasn't that really high-quality thinking wasn't required. It is. It was that the solution set and the world outcomes changed so quickly that what we really needed was smart, outcome-oriented people who could make very fast, distributed decisions. And finding a team of people who could make distributed decisions rather than be directed by a CEO, at least in that kind of space, the online space, was critical. And partly because of those fast, distributed decisions, we ended up buying Ticketmaster, buying Match.com, which were great complementary businesses to an online city guide, and eventually we bought Microsoft Sidewalk, which was our competitor city guide. And so the lessons, and it doesn't take that long to talk about them, is that, you know, winning requires this almost ruthless intensity, and finding people who can sustain that intensity is really difficult. And no matter how well you've thought through the game, the strategy of the game, that the game morphs so quickly that you've got to have people who can make those decisions just as quickly. And the biggest insight I found was the difference between having kind of A or A minus people as opposed to B minus people was the entire difference between succeeding and not succeeding. Because a B quality person, at least at that time in that space, wasn't bad enough to fire, but if they were in a critical position in the business, they weren't good enough to help you win. And you know, that's one of those lessons that has really stuck with me, and I think also into the next set of businesses that I was involved in, which were nonprofit businesses. I think it may not be true in every business that there are a few that have such high quality insights behind them, or in spaces where there's an increasing returns to scale, you know, like eBay or Match.com, which was of course one of our subsidiary businesses, or maybe Honest Tea. But in every other institution I worked in, that's been the secret. And it sounds obvious and it sounds simple. And what it meant, at least in our case, was putting much more time into hiring than you think you have. And it meant constantly evaluating people. And it didn't require being a people person, but it required paying attention to that in a much more intense way than I ever expected as a strategy consultant. And my whole talk distilled down to one paragraph, and then I'll cede the floor, is when you're in the process of hiring something, all the information in the world adds up to about 30%. For all the information from an interview adds up to about 30% of what you actually need to know. And the reason is that there are many people who are great performers in interviews who are actually mediocre performers in their jobs. And so, since you wouldn't want to make a decision based on 30% of the available information, how do you get the other 70%? And what people will say is, well, you check references. And then they usually hire a recruiting firm to check references. And they've missed the entire point, that it requires you personally doing it. And it requires doing it in such a way that you end up talking to a group of people who know the candidate very well and have more of a reason to tell you the truth about the candidate than they have to be loyal to that candidate. And in our case, it meant what we called going off-road, which is looking at a resume and imagining all the people who should have been given as references. And you can usually see on a resume the jobs they've had, and then where are the references that they didn't tell you? And then actually calling those people and keeping at it until you actually knew all of the issues about that person, and every single person has issues. And I never stopped until I knew what the problems were as well as the good sides of those particular people. And that's what clarity required. And it's not something you can delegate to a recruiter. A recruiter is actually in the business of selling you, not in the business of really helping you. And at least in our case, that usually meant something like 10 or 20 hours on my part for every senior person. And it often meant, as I said, trying to figure out what they didn't want you to know while you were doing it. And of course, the other thing is, once people were in place, was putting in place an evaluation system that both helped inspire the team, but also made sure that people were in the right places. And I know that sounds like not that giant an insight, but for me, as a young entrepreneur who thought strategy was everything, you know, learning that insight about putting the right critical people in the critical spot was a huge percentage of being successful. And that's it. All I get to say. Thanks, Barry.
We're glad you're in charge of the people part now. That's for sure. Let's see if I. Where the. I'm not quite sure how to make it go into a slide mode,
yeah,
you know?
Let's see.
Yeah, down at the bottom.
Right here. Oh, pardon me.
Look at that. Start.
How did you?
I think you did. Okay. So, start myself. Here we go. This is a story of a Yale professor, that's me, and, that's pretty well, and his student, that's Seth, who started a company called Honest Tea. I think I'm maybe the 10% and he's the 90% there. The idea of the company is pretty simple. It's tea that tastes like tea in a bottle. And it won't necessarily go over that well in the UK, but for the rest of the world, there's a hope. If you think about this, a professor and his students starting a company, going up against Coke, Pepsi, and the like, sounds like a recipe for disaster. And yet somehow we grew the business from 5 thermoses to over 100 million bottles a year. And the answer? Passion, luck, and economic theory. Seth and Mr. Passion, you'll hear about luck, and the 10% economic theory, that's me. Now, you look at the world out there, and there's every single flavor you can imagine. Lemon, lime, root beer, colas, uncolas, every size, every caffeine level. Is there anything possibly missing in the market? And yet we were thirsty, and we couldn't find anything we wanted to drink. Water is boring, diet is dangerous, and sodas are basically liquid candy. And so that suggested that there should be an opportunity. What that slide says you can't read is there a hole or is it a good thing? That is, if it's a hole, do you want to fall into it? Or is it something that actually is a great idea? And to answer that question, I think you need theory. So I like to say there's nothing so practical as good theory. And the question is, how do you know where there is an opportunity in the market? Now, I'm trained as an economist, and the first lesson we teach people is declining marginal utility. So the first unit of sugar takes away the bitterness, the next adds a little bit of flavor, and every additional bit of sugar is less and less valuable. And so I think the right type of product should be a little sweet, not too sweet. Or if I were to graph taste versus sugar, my view is that the optimal product does not go to the top of the curve. If you do a blind taste test, you'll be led to go to the top. But if you think about this in the context of declining marginal utility, the marginal utility at the top of the curve is zero. And so if you cut back sugar, the customer saves calories, we save cost of ingredients. And so therefore, the best product, the right product, is not the one that tastes the best. If you go back to high school, the derivative at a maximum is zero. And so therefore, when you cut back sugar, you lose almost nothing in terms of flavor. But you save calories, we save ingredient cost. And so therefore, we had economics telling us the right product shouldn't be too sweet. Okay, now the question is, what's the right not-too-sweet product? And for years, I was stuck on the idea of mixing orange juice and club soda. I loved it. How many of you do that? Okay, so great idea. The problem with most good ideas is they're not a good business. And I figured if we did that, we'd be test marketing for Tropicana, who would come in and crush us. And I'd be bitter, you wouldn't have me talk here today, it all wouldn't be good. And so the question is, what is the right less sweet beverage? And it turns out, just by luck, I ended up going to India. And I went to India to write a case study on Tata Tea, and while I was there, I learned three things. One, I'm not a tea connoisseur, but I could tell the difference between great tea and crappy tea. Two, great tea only costs a nickel a cup. And three, I should stick to my day job. Plucking tea is not the way to go. Now, if it turns out that great tea is a nickel a cup, and I could tell the difference, then economic theory comes to the rescue again. There's something called the Alkean-Allen theorem, which is sometimes better known as the babysitter theorem. It says if you're going to spend $50 for a babysitter, you're not going to go out to McDonald's. Why? Because then it costs $70 to go to McDonald's. Nobody thinks that's worth it. In our case, the babysitter is the bottle. That is, it costs 50 cents to fill a bottle with air. Put a label on it, put a cap on it, put it through the filling line. So if you're going to spend 50 cents on our babysitter, you might as well put something good inside. And I discovered that for a nickel, you could put something great inside, and even non-tea connoisseurs could tell the difference between good stuff and bad stuff. And so now we had economic theory telling us two things. One, it should be less sweet. Two, it should be high quality. And neither of those things were in the market. So when I see theory and I see practice and they're not going together, I'm willing to bet on theory. Well, we had this idea now of doing tea, and the question is, who would lead it? And that's when my student Seth came into play, Mr. 90%. We didn't have to change the market in the sense that people already in the U.S. order iced tea as their primary drink for lunch. Could we do for tea what Starbucks had done for coffee? And lastly, and as importantly, tea is one of the healthiest foods on the planet. It has antioxidants, flavonoids, and so if we could get people to drink more tea, we would be doing more with our social mission. Let's take sugar out of the diet and put in antioxidants. So that could get you excited about this, not like Bill Gates, I'm going to make a lot of money and give it away, but I'm going to sell a product that's great for people. We hired a local designer, and the charge was, make this thing look like a wine. And so you can see the tea is the keyhole into the art of the culture. Little specks on the yellow remind you of the tea crate. The black border. We're probably the only beverage company with taste first sugar on the back label, but you understand why now. So we get a chance to tell our story. We took an old Snapple bottle, we washed off the label, put on the laser printed one with rubber cement, spray painted the cap black, filled it up with tea we made in a thermos, brought it to the buyer at Whole Foods. He sampled it, he understood it, this was the pitch. You're selling this crap on the right, here's a chance to sell tea that tastes like tea on the left. He bought 15,000 bottles, we were in business. Luck came into play, I was at yoga, Oprah was on the mat on my right, I had samples with me. Obama is another fan. It turns out we got ourselves in the political campaign. He was viewed as an elitist for drinking honest tea. I don't know why. Our sales began to take off. This was good, but we didn't really understand what our business was about. The name Honest Tea is cute. We thought it was about the tea. We went into tea bags. That was a mistake. What our real business was about was honest. And once we understood that, a company you could trust, we started looking for other things that could be made honest. And the place in particular we went to was kid beverages. This Capri Sun, 110 calories for 6.75 ounces, that's sweeter than soda. So we knocked the calories down from 110 to 40, took out the high fructose corn syrup, made it organic, doubled the price, and it was one of the best things we ever did. It's now a third of our business. The company, as you can see, has grown the way you'd like. Coca-Cola decided this is something they're interested in. Bought the company 2 years ago. We don't think we sold out, we think they bought in, and it's a chance to really have 10 times the influence, because if they can sell a billion bottles rather than 100 million, we'll have more impact. I thought I'd end with just some personal reflection. So what is it that you do when you can do what you want? And I'm proud to say I'm in the same house with the same wife, going to do the same job at Yale. But I do have another beverage company, and that is, let me explain, we made this great product called kombucha. Kombucha is fermented tea. It is to tea what yogurt is to milk. Unfortunately, it fermented a little bit too much. Lindsay Lohan ended up drinking it and got drunk. And so we had to pull it from the market. But they say in software, when you have a bug, turn it into a feature. So we've created a new product called kombucha. And the idea here is it is mildly alcoholic fermented tea. We have the right license. The motto is get tickled, not pickled. So. Thank you very much. John, I don't know where you are in this. Roxanne, do you want to help out here on this?
Don't sit down for a second, Barry. Before Barry sits down, maybe I was an investor in, can you hear me? I was an investor in Barry's company, and I thought that we should all take advantage of his books. So I've got 100 of Barry's latest book sitting in the back. So before you leave, make sure you take a couple. There's a few of you. There's about 10 boxes back there. So
I only brought 10, John.
I bought it was hard to get them over here, about 100 of them.
Wow. Thank you.
Which one?
Thank
you,
John.
This is well, look, I was actually an investor in Barry's business, a great business. What he didn't tell you was one of the economic theories I learned is you have to make a profit. The business never made a profit, ever, until he sold the Coca-Cola. So, and then the shareholders made a profit. So, anyway, I'm going to talk about something a little different today. I'm going to talk about you never know when you've had a good day. And I want to go over some things people don't talk too much about is failures. And there were a lot of failures along my way to have some success. And I want to go over them today. The first one was I lost at All Ontario Wrestling. And I'll never forget that. The second one was, I was fired at my first job as a swim instructor at the city of Niagara Falls. Then I lost 34 scholarships. I have a world record in that. You can look at Guinness, page 398. I lost 34 scholarships when I applied to go to Harvard Business School when I was in Oxford. Then I was fired from my first professional job when I asked to take 2 weeks off to buy a business. Got worse. The funder of the company I eventually bought refused to continue our expansion. He went bankrupt. We were in the... I can't read that. See. Okay. The biggest market for our business was the classified advertising market in the United States, and we were outbid in basically all our bids there. When we did have the business, we sold... I'm one back here. In 1997, we sold our whole business to a public American company where I was the largest individual shareholder. And in 1998, I remember getting the call in February, and they had one of the largest accounting frauds, and we lost hundreds of millions of dollars on that transaction. Then in 2000, a few weeks before we went public, my wife left me for another man, causing havoc for my life and for my three children. My personal life was in turmoil. And then in 2005, we were about to sell our business, our whole company, for over $1 billion. And the buyer, Rupert Murdoch, called me to say he was no longer interested in buying our business. And the next day, he announced that they bought MySpace for $580 million. But what I said earlier is you never know when you had a good day. So these things do turn around. And there were many good days, as you'll see. So the first one was when I lost at wrestling in grade 11, Ontario Championships, I learned about leadership as a student leader. And I was student government representative, later became president of my high school and president of McGill University where I was a student. When I was fired as a swimming instructor, I started a competitor to my city of Niagara Falls swimming program. And I taught in 20 private pools, and this allowed me to go to McGill University, and I paid my way through school then. In the 34 scholarships I lost, I won the 35th, and I actually got a full scholarship to Harvard Business School, but I'm the only person ever to get somebody to pay a scholarship to go to a business school. When I was fired from my first professional job, which was a bit of a sad thing, at 29 years old, I bought AutoMag, which is a predecessor of Trader Classified Media. I bought it for $5 million of borrowed money, and I took my stock option of $200,000 and invested that. It was my first professional job was lost, but I had 72.5% of a company, which we started and worked and owned for 19 years. When the funder of the company went bankrupt 2 years after we bought the business, I was able to buy his shares very cheaply. And my initial $200,000 valuation 2 years later jumped to a value of $20 million. His stake, which we bought back for $7 million, would have been worth $630 million if he'd be able to keep it. When I lost almost all the bids in the United States for classified advertising, I moved from Montreal to Paris and then on to Geneva, and we bought most of the business everywhere else in the world. By 2004, we had the largest classified advertising empire in the world, with leading positions in Australia, Russia, Spain, France, Italy, Hungary, Canada, Argentina, Mexico, Croatia, Brazil, and over a dozen other countries. When we sold the business at this massive fraud, this gave us the opportunity to buy it back, and we bought back the business at a very reasonable price and continued to grow it for another 8 years. When my personal life was in turmoil, in 2001 I was able to get back on my feet. I met Marcy, my present wife. We were married, we have two children, and in addition, we were able to buy back the business from my ex-wife and my partner at a very reasonable price and return to that same 72.5% of the company. As T.S. Eliot says, in my beginning is my end. When Rupert Murdoch pulled out in July 2005, I remember to this day him calling me, we sold the business in parts at a great price. So I guess my message to today is also about risk-taking. And of all the people, my one message to Rhodes Scholars is, of all the people, Rhodes Scholars are the people our society needs to take risks. And we need that for two reasons. Number one is, as leaders, you're the people who are going to take the risks to change the world. And secondly, you have the lowest downside. Your downside is not that serious. You've got other options if you don't succeed in what you're doing. I'll go back, actually. And you can read the two quotes, but J.K. Rowling said that, you know, if you haven't taken risk in your life, you really haven't lived. And in some ways, Nietzsche said it best in saying that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. So unfortunately, too many of Rhodes Scholars are not taking those risks. So I encourage you to do that, because avoiding that inner voice of taking risks with confidence is probably not good for you, but also not good for society. So that was my little message to you, and I hope that we take risks, be persistent, and never give up. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. It's quite an esteemed panel here today, and me. When I showed up, I was quite intimidated, and I showed up, and the first person I saw was Bob at Rhodes House, and he said to me, my name's Yusuf, and he said to me, "Useless, what are you doing here? I thought they only had top men on the program. How did they get let you on?" So I'll do my best. I graduated from Oxford 2009, and I moved back to South Africa convinced that in the poorest communities in our country, there are young people with the same raw entrepreneurial potential as people like Richard Branson, but who are stuck making £300-400 a month because of the way South Africa works, because of how profoundly unfair our society is. And that struck me as something that I wanted to do something about, but also as a huge opportunity, because I felt like if we could effectively identify and invest in the people who had that talent, and get them from £300-400 a month to hundreds of thousands of pounds a month or millions of pounds a month, not as a charity but as a business, then we could have a massive social and financial impact. And so that's what I set out to do 4 years ago. When the question is why I actually started to believe that, because when I left high school in South Africa, I definitely didn't think we could compete with people at the likes of Oxford or Harvard. In fact, I had a little bit of developing country inferiority complex going on. You know, I thought the people in these institutions are incredible, and they're superhuman, really. But I got here. Undergrad, I went to, maybe you know what I mean. Undergrad, I went to Harvard, postgrad to Oxford, and I had the experience. I got confident and settled, and I started to realize people are just people, you know. So this is a picture of the senior common room, I think, at Oriel. And on my first cocktail party there, this philosophy don from Argentina, he heard that I was interested in business, and he pulled me to one side, and he wanted to tell me quietly, because he didn't want people to steal his idea, and he said, you know,
if you buy things for cheap and you sell them for a bit more than you bought them for, well, you make a profit.
So those kind of experiences showed me that people are not superhuman, and then just going...
I never got that lesson.
Economic theory. You know, so just going back and forth. I went back and forth between South Africa and abroad the whole time I was here. And every time I went home, I felt like I interacted with people who were smarter than me, harder working, better leaders, more creative, and they're just never going to get the chances that I was getting or that my peers at these institutions were getting. And so experientially, I just felt like that talent was there. But also just logically, South Africa is one of the most unequal countries in the world. And we've never given people a chance to show what they can do. So if you never give people a chance, why would you expect that the talent distribution in that group of people is any different to any other group of people? Some people won't be that talented, but you'd also have world-class talent. And so I became convinced of this idea. But it's all very well being convinced of an idea. Why did I actually want to act on it? So what was my passion for wanting to go back and do something about this? So this is my family. So I think the roots of my passion are in my family. This is when my sister was born in the 80s, and you can see my dad's an Indian South African guy, my mum's a Welsh white lady, and it was actually illegal for them to be married in apartheid South Africa. There was something called the Mixed Marriages Act, which made it illegal for them to be married. So we grew up as this mixed race family in this country obsessed by race, which is quite a weird and uniquely South African experience. And so just to give you a sense of what that was like, you can see, so at one stage every single member of my family had a different racial classification. And yeah. And that's my little brother there on the left. You see he's got this nice chocolatey skin. And so that meant the guys who did the registration, the population registration, they couldn't identify what race he was. So my mum had to take him back twice to the registration office. And you can imagine it's like a home affairs office with the glass in the front. So the second time she brought him back and the guy still couldn't figure out what's this baby. So he gets on the phone to his superior and he says, this is what my mum tells me, I wasn't there. But he gets on the phone to his superior and says, I don't know what this baby is. And so he hears it and says to my mom, so what are you? She says, I'm Caucasian. He goes, she says she's some other kind of Asian. So, yeah, a weird way to grow up, a weird country to grow up in, but it really tied me to this idea of myself as a South African, but more importantly as a new South African who really believed in this idea of a country where everyone is going to get treated equally, because my family wasn't treated equally. And as I got older and I realized the idea of the new South Africa, this rainbow nation idea, which you all saw in Invictus, was a great idea, but not actually reality, right? We actually, for the majority of people in our country, we still don't give a fair chance. And that made me angry and made me want to do something. So I came back, had an idea, I was 26, had these good credentials, and I had the passion to do something about it. So there's world-class talent, let's invest in these people and get them to economically really realizing their potential. And we started in Alex, which is a township in Joburg, about 500,000 people, about 65% youth unemployment, some of the highest rates of HIV/AIDS and crime in the world. And we started, and just to give you a sense of how clueless we were, so I was 26, and there were about five of us going in on the first day, and in the group we had a debate about how we should go in. And some people said it was a bit unsafe to go by ourselves. We needed protection or we shouldn't go in by ourselves. So we convinced the police station outside Alex to give us an escort. So, on our first day, going into a community where we plan to spend the rest of our careers, we went with three police cars. We didn't have our own cars, just in the police cars. And as the police cars entered the community, they put their blue lights on. So they started flashing. So essentially our messaging was to the community of people there was, we believe in your talent. We want to enter long-term business partnerships with you. We just don't trust you enough to be here without police. So please bear with us and hopefully over time we'll calm down. So that's how little we knew about what we were doing. But over the last 4 years, we've been really figuring this thing out. And so for the first 3 years, really, I worked with six entrepreneurs. We took 2,000 applicants, and three of them dropped out, and three we actually built little micro businesses with. And nothing like them. If you look at those numbers you've seen so far, you just drop quite a few zeros, and that's the kind of business we're working with. So literally businesses that got up to $1,000 a month in profit, and that was a huge success for us. But government got wind of what we were doing, and they funded us to really try to scale this thing. So in the last year, we've taken in 25,000 applicants. We now, at the end of this month, we'll have 500 entrepreneurs in our incubator. With those, we hope to create 1,000 new jobs, and at a cost per job to government of about £1,300 in subsidy, which would make us one of the lowest cost and most scalable job creation solutions in the country. And job creation and youth unemployment is probably our most urgent and dangerous problem in South Africa, and I guess in a lot of countries. In the next 3 years, the goal is 10,000 entrepreneurs in the incubator to invest £100,000 each in the best 1,000 of them and to take equity in those businesses. So as they grow, so we make money. So to invest about £100 million and to create about 17,500 jobs. So these are all aspirational figures. We definitely aren't there yet. And I was reminded of the fact that we aren't there yet by the fact that the last 2 days I stayed in Paris and I couldn't afford a hotel room. So this is the hostel where I stayed. And there's nothing to remind you that you haven't quite made it, like like when you collect your sheets at check-in and you hand them back at check-out. But we are making a lot of progress. And so in fact, I have to leave here just to give you, I have to leave here this evening, unfortunately, but it's because the finance minister has heard about the work that we're doing and we're presenting to him on Friday to try to get the kind of funding we need to get to 10,000 entrepreneurs. So we are making progress, and I think if we keep going like this, we can change the way South Africa works. So my message, Barry asked us to have one message. I guess it's Africa is a great place to do well and do good, and that's what we're trying to do, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Somewhat amazingly, people were on time, and that means we have at least 20 minutes for questions. So the floor is yours, and please. So just identify yourself, name, year.
Right. David Walton, 1971. I was interested in the... I didn't get your name on the right, the McKinsey guy.
Oh, Charles.
Charles.
Charles is our... Charles is... Is he serious?
Say it, maybe.
Charles is our new, he's our new warden.
Oh, warden. That's that, it's like getting those sheets back. Haven't quite made it yet.
Charles.
Work on your PR there,
yes. Thanks, Charles. Yes, I won't forget. In your recruitment, which you said you spent a lot of energy in the recruitment, you didn't mention psychometrics or anything of that ilk, and I just wondered whether you ever thought that that was helpful.
I think it's a great question, and it's something I think I've learned more about in the last 4 or 5 years than then. Actually, most recently, when I was down in Cape Town for the Mandela Roads 10th, I met with... Tim Cumming, who might even be here, and they do use some psychometric testing with the Mandela Road Scholars that help, not the standard Myers-Briggs stuff, but that help understand the leadership styles of the different potential Mandela Road Scholars, and I think there's some value in it. I will tell you that I did try that idea on with the national secretaries over the last 2 days, and it was pretty roundly dismissed as a potential technique for sorting out who might be a good Road Scholar or not. I will tell you that I recently went through a full profile with both myself and then a bunch of my friends, and it actually did give me quite a lot of insight into how I interact with people. So I don't think it's valueless. I never found it, I didn't discover it when I was doing my heaviest recruiting. But good question.
All the way in the back corner. That's you, yeah.
Yeah. Ronan Farrow, 2012. This is for Roxanne. It's about the role of advocacy in the types of charitable organizations that you run, that you work with. Looking at both your own organization and the broader landscape, how do you, in good conscience, tell young people to give their time and resources to groups that work not exclusively on providing services on the ground, but also on a more nebulous project of advocacy? Obviously, your WE Days and a lot of what Free the Children does is exactly that type of advocacy. And I've actually had this tough conversation with people that have come up to me and said, how do I get involved with one of the groups? And I always am forced to, as much as I admire your work, point them away from groups that do advocacy, because I think that's something that can be self-generated, and if you're going to give those harder resources, they'd better go to someone like Save the Children, where it's all on the ground provision of services. So what's your answer to that?
Yeah, sure. Well, we really believe in providing young people the tools to become active social citizens. And so our We Day and We Act program, for example, which I spoke about, really provides concrete, a year-long concrete initiatives that young people can get involved in without the course of the year, so that they can actually get tangible experience in learning about different social issues that affect them. So, and I don't want to go into deep detail, but we do have, for example, Halloween for Hunger in North America, where we encourage young people to trick-or-treat for canned goods instead of for candy. We have an Aboriginal Spotlight, where non-Aboriginal Canadians have an opportunity to learn about Aboriginal issues in Canada. We actually really believe it's important to empower young people and to ignite their passion and to really couple that with their gift, so that they actually can become valuable citizens within the community later on. So we actually believe, I see what you're saying, which is let's allocate resources to organizations that do things on the ground, and we do that from an international development perspective, and we don't necessarily do it the best, but we're doing what we do, and I have nothing but compliments for our other partners in this process. I just think this investment is really important. We're seeing the social returns, and I think overall we're better off in the long term.
But to make it more granular, is it then worth paying to fly Oprah to We Day to achieve that? You know, if the question is all money goes to a refugee camp with you give to one group, or it goes to filling a stadium and bringing a bunch of celebrities, sure. I agree the advocacy is important. I just always have, when it comes down to that moment of an earnest young person asking, what can I do? It's really tough when so much of the overhead goes to these kind of buzz-generating events and big names and the glitz and glam.
These events are supported through corporate dollars that would not otherwise go to philanthropy, so we're just actually really excited to get other corporate partners on board to be able to do something that's good rather than spend it on something that we may never learn about. So we're finding it's just actually we're getting more people into the tent, and we're finding it's actually very effective. And just for the record, no one has provided a stipend to come and attend We Day. Everybody volunteers their time, and nobody can buy a ticket to We Day. Kids have to earn their way through service through a local and a global action. So we actually feel that's actually a very democratic event, and we're getting a lot more people into the tent, and we're getting a better outcome because of it. But I can appreciate what you're saying, and I think the really key thing in our part here is that we have that accompanying year-long initiative of different actions that can take place, so it's not just a pep rally for one day.
Yeah. The air in the blue, yeah.
If you were all in your...
Oh, who are you?
Oh, sorry. Joelle Faulkner, Wadham, 2005, Ontario. If you were all going to do one thing differently over the course, what would it have been?
I just answered a difficult question.
Go ahead, Charles.
I'll go. It's easy. I would not have done all sorts of distractions. We bought a bottling plant. That was very expensive for us. We went into a teabag line. That was expensive. Again, a big mistake. And so... figuring out what it is that you love doing, that you're good at, and not getting distracted by opportunities that look like they're opportunities, but really are holes.
Yeah, I think my answer would probably be a variant of that, which is anytime you start a new enterprise, there's a million great ideas, and the trick is not how you can pursue those million ideas, it's how you can pursue the three right things. And we made so many ridiculous mistakes building Ticketmaster, City Search, and Match.com, and almost all of them were trying to do five things when it was actually three things that were required to be done. You know, and actually the biggest mistakes we made were in thinking that it made sense to partner with existing media companies to get a lift on our game. And every single time we did that, it ended up either helping them or hurting us, never the reverse.
Is it?
I'd be better at taking advice. I think it's not an issue that I don't want people's advice, it's just that if you don't prioritize it every day, or if you don't prioritize it in your day-to-day work, then you don't make time for it. And so I think I could have shortcutted a lot of the lessons that we've had to learn through experience. Just, we have an incredible advisory board of 8 people who all have 3 decades of experience on me, and I've met with them probably 3 times each in the last 4 years. So I'd really try to make time for advice.
John?
I'm just trying to sort the mistakes. No, I think what I would have...
We only have 10 minutes, right?
What I think Barry said a good one is not knowing what you're really good at. I know, remember the audience, Sean Riley and I, one of the businesses we started together was a kitchen countertop business. That's not a good business, as Sean and I know. And it took a little while to figure that out. You know? So we had a good business. So I think sometimes being able to figure out what businesses have a long-term potential and seeing them. We were slow at seeing the internet. We basically sold our way out of the internet issue in some ways, although we were bigger in China and internet. So I always wonder if we'd almost had a company of two cultures, or one culture, more internet culture, our existing culture, whether we could have been a big player in the internet and maybe kept the business today. But instead we sold, which was fine. But it's always a wonder, how do you create a second business that's coming up and trying to be master of two, and we weren't able to do that.
I think for myself, I'd have to say, and I ask this question to myself every single day, so it was, how can I be a better leader for my team? And it's really about listening, and it's about being less reactive. And if I look back on some of the conversations I've had with people like 5 years ago, I cringe in embarrassment. Just really trying to mature in that process. And the other key piece I would say is looking at the data. I think we really functioned on hunches for a long time. I still think there's a place for gut and hunches in business, for sure. But it's also looking at the data, and it is really amazing what you can see now when you send out an e-blast and when you look at the click-throughs, and you can get a sense where people are spending their time. So every day is full of learning, that's for sure.
You're a patient?
Hi, Amr Dahan, Saskatchewan, 2003. Question for you, Professor. How do you balance your academic profile, commitments with your entrepreneurship, and how do you relate to your colleagues? How do they relate to you? And how do you use your theory forward, like you showed us, but then get back to the theory as well?
Yeah. So I guess two thoughts. One is none of my colleagues invested in this business, which is kind of amusing. Many of my consulting clients and classmates and co-authors did. As I said, there's nothing so practical as a good theory, so I believe that what we learned in the real world, we should take into the classroom, and what we do in the classroom, we should bring to the real world. If it isn't connected to the world, then I'm not quite sure why it is we're doing it. The nice thing is the theories don't have to be that complicated. And so what's different about a business school is your students don't want to be like you. If you're a PhD, the next generation, they want to be a PhD, it's sort of that mentorship program. Here, they don't want to become business school professors, they want to be entrepreneurs or consultants or something. And I'd say that the understanding what goes right, what goes wrong, how you turn an idea into a company is really as Charles said, it does require people. But I will push back a little bit. I'd say that getting the concept right at the start is incredibly important. We're one of the only companies I know where if you look at the business plan, we actually did exactly what it is that we said in our business plan. Yes, you want to be flexible. Yes, you want to be able to pivot. But it's also good to have the idea understood right at the front. Sir, in the middle with the, yes, there you go.
Yeah.
Sorry. We'll have you next. How's that?
Tony Abrahams, Australia, 1998. It's a question really for the panel, and it's moving beyond today. It's a fantastic presentation, and thank you all for it. Is there a way to really harness our community to link those with the experience, the mentoring, the capital, with those who have ideas who could benefit from that in a way better than we've been able to do today?
I'm going to put that to Charles.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Absolutely. And I think we got the ball rolling 3 or 4 years ago, and Don Markwell did a remarkable job beginning to reconnect us. So far, it's been pretty Web 1.0, where we're, you know, Rhodes House is doing a better job communicating what's happening in Oxford, and we have a bunch of one-way communication coming back. The next step for us, and it really is literally right after the reunion, is to begin to build a proper Rhodes online network so that we can link to each other in all the complicated ways that make sense. Some of it's pretty obvious, which is the younger Rhodes Scholars really would like to get access to the older Rhodes Scholars to get career advice. sometimes it's the most straightforward thing, which supervisor's, you know, great for doing organic chemistry. And sometimes it's much more complicated things like, how do I become an ambassador? But if those are kind of obvious things, I think if we can build this so that in an opt-in way that people describe not only what degree they, you know, not only their standard identifier, Tennessee, Merton, 1964, but talk about what they care about, what they're good at, and what they're willing to help other people in, we could actually begin to use the Rhodes community in a much more fundamental way than we have. One of the things that has occurred to me is we have this amazing 110-year-old institution, and almost its entire reputation is based on your individual achievement. Not much of that is based on our collective achievement, what we could do together. And some of that will be building businesses, some of it will be building social enterprise, and I think a whole lot of it will be all those spaces in between.
Sir?
Rick Lee, New South Wales, 1971. I was interested, and I think either Barry or John, as the entrepreneur and I gather the investor in Honest Tea, and investor, the financial history, your product development history and sales history and things were really interesting and impressive, but behind that there must have been some financial kind of challenges, because I don't know over what period the company grew, but normally what intervenes is the capacity or well, lack of capacity funding. I'm just interested in a bit of a pot of financial history.
So due to John's generosity, the book will actually tell you all about that. Literally, I mean, it's open source in the sense that it's a manual for our people. I'll just tell you one thing that we did that's really weird, but I kind of am proud of. We went for a zero pre-money valuation, which meant the investors who put in the first $500,000 owned 100% of the company, which was hard for them to argue with because you can't have anything better than that. And then the question is, what did the entrepreneurs get, the founders? And what we did is we had options that were out of the money. And so when we doubled people's share price, we started getting something. When we tripled, we got more. When we 5 times, 10 times, and 15 times. And so essentially, the investors were put ahead of the founders. At the same time, we say, we think this business is going to grow to $100 million in sales. So we think it's worth a couple hundred million. Nobody would really believe you. You'd pick out of the air, you'd say a market cap of 5 million, but you've made that up. If you really believe the company's worth a lot more than that, then essentially we made a conditional valuation, which is if we can get to a valuation of 100 million, then wasn't it right to pick 20 up front? And so essentially by having all those options, we ended up not being diluted by the end. We had 40% of the company, but we started with zero. And that was also, I guess, a little unusual, but I'll recommend it if you're...
Just on the same line, there's sort of two ways. A lot of talk of Rhodes Scholars is starting business from nothing, right? There is another way. So the business Barry started had to be 100% equity finance, really. So, you know, you to not get diluted, you know, Barry had a very good idea, and when the business is a home run, everybody wins, and we as investors felt very good about it. When it's a normal progression on that system, you do get diluted a lot, and that's the tough part. The other way I've asked Rhodes Scholars to look at it is in the trader one, we ran a business for 19 years, started the first day at 72.5% of the company, and a few ups and downs, ended up the last day at 72.5% of the company. And there's very few, even the Google founders didn't do that. And the reason is we found a business with stable, growing cash flow, and we were able to finance it with banks and debt. And that was, yes, it's risky, but we had a very stable business. And that's another way of looking at things. And there's still lots of innovation in stable business, but a lot of people, young people always look at, well, I don't have the money, therefore I'll do a startup. The other way is, I don't have the money, therefore I'll borrow somebody else's money, which is my strategy.
Actually, I want to give one of John's pieces of advice that I think was one of the best advices I ever got. When you're borrowing money, it doesn't matter what interest rate you're paying, it matters what terms you have. And that a lot of people are way too focused on, oh, can I pay 8% or 6%, as opposed to what are the covenants they put on there. And in the end of the day, having a loan that isn't going to be called because you've gone out of bounds is so much more important. And that's something that we really benefited from.
We always say, your price, my terms.
Sir?
John Wiley, Queensland 1983. A question for you, John. You've invested in hundreds of businesses and been amazingly successful. What are the things you've learned from in terms of the characteristics of entrepreneurs that you look for, and you know, what's the sort of characteristics of entrepreneurs that pay off for you, and what have you learned to avoid?
Yeah, well, one of the things we've learned to avoid is not invest in Harvard Business School graduates. I think I'm one of the only ones. We've had an enormously terrible experience in that area. The company that we sold the business to, you remember my little slide, the failure of selling this company, the fraud, the two guys are still, Harvard MBA, still in jail today. So I think the first thing is ethics. I'm really, we've had some unbelievable...
How do you really feel about each one?
No, we actually, and another two, this gentleman was our head of France, and he have got this really good friend, and hired him, and next thing you know, we learned that what he was doing was he was going in the United States and printing up Electricité de France bills and sending to people in France with his bank account number on it and collecting everybody's utility bills. So he was called out of jail by the other Harvard MBAs working for us. We had two, we had to fire there. So that's my first rule. I think ethics is really important, and I don't want to overstate that. It really is important. You can't trust the people. Second thing I've done, and it's maybe a fault, we have a very loyal team. So I'm trying to be very loyal to people and bring them in. And so I'm working with people today, the president of my family office, I'm here at Oxford. We have a very loyal team, I think that's the second thing. And the third thing on entrepreneurship is people that don't hear the word no. So I'm very persistent, as probably anybody who knows me knows, I'm extremely persistent, I'm like a pain in the ass. So I think that's the third thing I look at entrepreneurs, is because there's so many no's you get along the way that you need persistence. And also, I guess maybe the last one, John, would be flexibility, because, you know, we as a Canadian, we saw so many Canadian companies that, you know, the Nirvana is going to the States. And we saw so many Canadian companies actually belly flop the United States. So we were able to say, no, we know this little sector, and we were able to be flexible to go to Europe. And I guess maybe the last point is focus. I think that too many people today are not focusing. So our business wasn't a media business. It wasn't a publishing business. It was a very small niche. But we knew that niche of buying and selling used vehicles, used trucks. We controlled most of the movement of used goods and basing for almost 15 years in Russia and to a training post in Australia. So you really knew that one little business niche. And I think for entrepreneurs, when you find the thing you like and you're good at and think it's a good business, really take the time to focus on. Don't sell too early. And we kept it for 19 years. And that was very, really good things. Too many people now are trying to make a quick buck and selling it too early. And having, obviously, cash flow allows us to do that, but also recognizing when to sell. But I think those are some of the key characters I look for entrepreneurs. But I think the first one is the most important. Ethics is really important.
I'm afraid we're out of time. However, I don't think any of us are about to run away. So please stay, come say hello, and don't leave.
Don't forget Barry's books.
Don't leave without a book, which I guess I'll go up and sign. So.
This podcast was recorded live on Wednesday, the 18th of September in the Sheldonian Theatre. The speakers were Roxane Joyal, Manitoba and Hartford, 2001, Charles Conn, Massachusetts and Balliol, 1983, Professor Barry Nailbuff, Massachusetts and Nuffield, 1980, John McCall McBain, Quebec and Wadham, 1980, and Yusuf Rendera-Rees, South Africa at Large and Oriel, 2007. To find out more, visit www.rhodeshouse.ox.ac.uk.